going to have to do an intro first. This is Dan Golodner, AFT Archivist, Wayne State University, Walter P. Reuther Library. It is August 21st, 2006. I'm in Austin, Texas with John Cole, part of the AFT Oral History Project. John, why don't we just get started with where you're born and raised and a bit about yourself.
I was born in Stamford, Texas in 1945. Stamford was then at the height, I think, of its prosperity. It claimed to have 5,000 people. It's possible. It's not. Anyway, my father at that time, was in my family, the Coles, were day laborers. They had been sharecroppers who were driven off their land by the Depression. The Grapes of Wrath kind of people. They picked cotton, chopped cotton. They'd do anything else, but in those days, cotton was the crop around cotton and cattle around that area of Texas. The other side of my family were railroad workers who were also laborers. My great-grandfather, who I knew quite well and lived with for a considerable part of the time, lived with he and my great-grandmother, swung a 9-pound hammer for 8 hours a day for Texas and Pacific Railway. Had come to Stamford building the first railroad there in 1904. And when that task was finished, he stayed on. They built a roundhouse in Stamford, which was part of its prosperity. Roundhouse is the place where the locomotives turned around, and also they did repair work on them. And there were 3 cotton gins there at that time. That was big prosperity. Anyway, our house was that my father was off fighting the Japanese when I was born. So I was living with my mother, was living with my great grandparents. And our house was at an intersection of 2 dirt roads across the street from a cotton field. It was a four-room house, but the 4 rooms were tiny. My great-grandfather built it with his own hands. He was about 5'2". He built it to scale, which meant it's the only place that I could feel tall. Whenever I stood up, my head did not hit the ceiling, but I hit the light fixtures, which were bare bulbs hanging down. Anyway, in many ways, my father's life and my life follow a trajectory that demographers would readily recognize in the post-war period. Born in this little small town, but my father saw there was no scope there for advancement whatsoever. So, in 1948, we moved to Abilene, which at that time had 40,000 inhabitants and was a big city by our thinking. Like everyone in my family, he was had very poor formal education. He officially dropped out of school in the 7th grade, but the truth is he hadn't attended school regularly. He never attended school for a whole year in his life. Mm-hmm. But he had this incredible mechanical aptitude. When he was a young man, still in his like early teens, 13 or 14, he was working at a dairy in addition to picking cotton. And as he walked to the dairy, he walked past the city dump, and someone had dumped a Model T there. So he and his brothers dragged it back to the family home, and he scrounged parts out of the dump and hither and yon and built it, rebuilt it, and got it running. So that with nobody ever telling him what those things were or how it worked or anything, he got this Model T up and running. And he was in a gas station with it one day, and this guy was there, and his LaSalle, which was a luxury car, had broken down, and the guy was desperate to get to Shreveport because of a family emergency. And the guy said to my father, "Kid, does your car run?" And he said, "Yes, it runs fine." He said, "All right, I'll trade you my LaSalle for your car." And my father said, "I'm on to something here." So he fixed up the LaSalle, got it running, and sold it for, obviously, considerable profit. So when he went off to war, he already had sort of the genesis of a career in his mind. And in the Army, when he was in the Philippines, when the Japanese surrendered, he fought in the Philippines and was there, and then got shipped in to be part of the Army of Occupation, which left him with lots of time on his hands. So he studied auto mechanics. And when he came back, got a job as an auto mechanic, and then eventually went on to open his own garage, and eventually built a career rebuilding wrecked automobiles. Now, when I was born, we moved to Abilene. Comparatively, compared to what the life my father led, I had a sort of a blessed life. I did have one shaping experience in that I was born with a birth defect, pretty mild. It's called a club foot. Mm-hmm. And my parents couldn't afford the operation to fix it. My father happened to be working with a Shriner, a guy who was a Mason, who got me into the Shriner Hospital for Crippled Children in Dallas. In those days, when you went to the hospital or something like that, you went for months. So I was there for like 3 months when I was 3 years old. Gave me an appreciation for I guess how well off I was compared to others. There was this one kid that had polio. This was in the days where polio was this terrible scourge, and this kid, he wasn't in an iron lung. I don't think they built iron lungs yet, but he had a breather on his chest, and he couldn't move. All he could do was lie flat. Mm. I can remember him calling out every 15 or 20 minutes, all 24 hours a day, "Nurse, come turn me over." Hmm. And then there was this other kid that they brought in who had been horribly burned. Anyway, in Abilene, I got there at sort of just the right time. Abilene, when I arrived, was a oil and ranch town, banking center heavy dose of cotton farming. Still, there was a lot of cotton farming going on, and it was the banking center for the area. Abilene, by the way, is in what is called West Texas. Now, my friends in El Paso make fun of that. Abilene's about 180 miles west of Dallas, right at the break in the plains, where between arable land and desert. So that Abilene is on the average desert 1 year out of seven. If you drive west of Abilene within 20 miles you're in creosote bush desert territories. If you drive east, you're in, it's pretty decent and totally flat. After I got there, Abilene hit a boom because there had been an Army base there, and the Air Force moved in. Dyess Air Force Base is still there. Went up to 100,000 people. There was a big population explosion. Of course, there was this demographic trend all over America of people leaving farms and small towns and going to cities. Mm-hmm. It was a definitely a southern kind of atmosphere when you're talking about race. There were not enough Hispanics there to mention. There were few blacks. They may have been 10% of the population. It's hard to say, but they were confined to a geographic area. There was a separate school down near the Gooch packing plant where nobody wanted to be. So all of this paid for, there were two school systems paid for with tax dollars, but I don't know what the ratio would be. 80% perhaps of the tax dollars went to the white schools, 20% went to the black.
Sure.
I don't think that would be far off the mark. Mm-hmm. So I had the advantage of being white and getting really a top quality education. Also, it was a time when women were not, they didn't have many career paths open to them. Basically, if you were a talented woman, ambitious, went to college, and wanted more than just to be a housewife, you could be a nurse, a secretary, or a teacher. With the result that some of the most talented, brilliant people you can imagine were teaching school. Mm-hmm. And doing it with a real conviction and dedication, because they were not ordinary women in the first place, in that they chose to break the mold and do something other than just stay home and keep house.
Right.
So, in those days, I like to say that those of us that were born in that era, born white Americans, won the lottery of life. It was a setup for success, even for somebody who started in extreme poverty, as I did. You know, the path upward was clear, and there was never any doubt that if I applied myself and worked hard, mm-hmm. I was going to be able to make it. So, I went to school in Abilene. When I graduated, I was in the band in high school. I also was in the family business. In those days, I rebuilt my first car when I was, my mother says I was 13. I remember it 14. My father felt that children should earn their keep.
Sure.
So he put me in the family business pretty early on. Any time I wasn't in school, I was available to go help rebuild cars. Started driving a truck, hauling wrecked cars or cars that we'd rebuilt when I was 14, even though I was not licensed to drive them. So by the time I got into teaching, I had already had a considerable career. In fact, about 10 or 11 years in another industry.
Yeah.
It helped shape my thinking about what was going on in education. Anyway, I went to McMurray College on a music scholarship. McMurray, there were three colleges in Abilene, still are. universities now. McMurray, which is Methodist, Hardin-Simmons, which is the Baptist, and Abilene Christian, which is Church of Christ. I have music scholarship offers from, I never considered Abilene Christian. They made, among other things, students had to go to chapel every day. And Hardin-Simmons offered me a scholarship, but they had, their claim to fame was the cowboy band, an all-male band. Mm-hmm. My experience in high school had taught me that if you were on bus trips overnight, you wanted girls along. So I didn't consider that one seriously at all. And I went for McMurray, even though I was raised as a Baptist, and Methodism was considered to be like really liberal religion. So I went to McMurray College, which turned out to be a wonderful experience. It's a small school, still is. In those days, I had about 1,700 pupils, smaller than my high school. Hmm. So I had an opportunity for an outstanding education.
So what did you play?
I played the trombone, and I was quite good. Later on, I took up guitar because all my friends were playing guitar.
I did the same thing.
It was in the 60s. I did play briefly in a dance band, but it was at the end of when people wanted to hear big band music. They wanted to hear rock and roll.
Right.
Okay. Anyway, graduating from Abilene, I went into teaching. I have to say, there are other parts of my life like that I did stupid things like get married. You know, I always think when I hear about people talking about these at-risk people with teenage mothers and all that, I was one of those.
Okay.
I did all those dumb things. I did every dumb thing you can imagine. Brushes with a law, just—it's like I've kind of think in my life. I've always had a theory that I had to try every wrong avenue first, you know, just to see that it was wrong before I finally fetch up in the right one. Anyway, I went into teaching actually, not out of any conviction that I wanted to be a teacher, but because I'd calculated how much money I had saved up working. I had to lay out of school and pay medical bills for a couple of years. My daughter was born very premature. Mm-hmm. And so I calculated up that I had, because so many of the courses you would take for a teaching degree were in a liberal arts school, the courses that everybody took, that meant my freshman and sophomore years were loaded up with all this stuff that I could apply towards a teaching degree, whereas if I went into, say, pre-law, I'd have to take a bunch of other courses I hadn't had already. And so that would string things out. So I calculated out how much it would take and decided that if I wanted to make the shortest, least expensive run possible to a degree, it would be as an English teacher, which I knew I did not want to really do. I wanted, if I were going to teach history, but I also knew that in Texas, if you teach history, you have to coach, which I didn't want to do. So that became the basis of this decision. I have to say also, in this era of people blaming the government for programs that they label as boondoggles and waste of money, I would never have made it without first national defense loans. Mm-hmm. Which covered my tuition in the later years. I had to drop out of the band after I got married and had a child because I had to work. There wasn't enough money playing in the band, in dance bands after, and besides, you had to go play at football games and things, and I had to go work. So, I got loans for my tuition from the National Defense Loan Foundation, and then I got some outright grants of money from the Office of Economic Opportunity, which helped pay for books and living expenses The OEO grants didn't have to be paid back. Now those, I think, vanished. The defense loan did, but that's another story. Anyway, graduating from Abilene, Abilene being Abilene, I mentioned the three church schools there. Mm-hmm. Used to say in Abilene that not only was there a place for everyone in church, there was actually a church for every individual person. And the Church of Christ dominated, a very austere religion. No public swimming pool. They had a swimming pool at the college, but it had a board fence built down the middle of it so that the girls and boys would not mix. Their cheerleaders wore long pants, as did their drum majorettes on the band. Dancing was not allowed in Abilene in those days. It was dry town, no alcohol. And then I've also in 1968 got into my first political activity when a closet moderate showed up as mayor of Abilene. Came from a really good family. Nobody could understand this. But without much thought or publicity, passed a Sydney ordinance saying that blacks could live west of Pine Street, which then ignited a firestorm of protests. There was a recall petition circulated, and he backed off to the degree of calling for a referendum on the topic. And this is the first time I was ever active in any political things, but it was in the air. This was 68.
Yeah. You're still in school, right?
I was still in school, in college, working. I called the mayor's office. He answered the phone himself. It was that kind of a town, and said, "Hi, can I help?" So I got involved in the referendum on allowing blacks to live west of Pine Street. That was my first political activism. We lost.
Yeah.
Yeah, about 3-1. It was pretty bad. But that and other experiences convinced me that what I wanted to do more than anything was get out of Abilene. So when it came time for graduation, school district sent in recruiters. Mm-hmm. And I was recruited by a number of them. And I accepted a position in Corpus Christi, which I had never seen. But there were two things. One, it wasn't Abilene. And two, there was water.
Right.
Corpus Christi's on the coast. I was fascinated by the thought of living where water was plentiful. In 69, I went to Corpus Christi and became a teacher. It was quite a culture shock. I got assigned, as most new teachers did, to a West Side school. West Side being where the African Americans and Hispanics were. And when I got there, they were in the process of complying with a court order to integrate African Americans so that the school that I was assigned to, the first thing they did was they did one-way busing. They closed the black schools and bused those kids out into the Hispanic schools. So the school that I had, that I was assigned to, was designed for 750 at 1,400 students.
Oh, jeez.
My first year was so traumatic, I had nightmares about it for years.
It was complete anarchy.
Yeah, and I'm handed the roll sheet, and I cannot read half the names.
Right.
It seemed like fully 50% of them were named Jesus, and the other 50 were named Yolanda or something. But they were actually Evangelinas, Diamantinas, Esperanzas, Santiago's. I didn't speak any Spanish to speak of. I had not taken a foreign language in college. And here I was supposed to be teaching, I think I had that year, a 7th grade English, 8th grade English, 7th grade history, 8th grade history, maybe doubling up on the 7th grade history. So I'm supposed to be teaching in the English class, you know, like writing a paragraph in 7th grade English anyway. We're going to be supposed to read Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol, and I remember that one.
How'd that go over?
Well, the telling thing was I picked up the teacher's guide hoping for some direction, and the very opening sentence I'll never forget said, "When our students arrive at school in first grade, they already have a good working knowledge of oral English. It is our task to translate those skills into good writing and reading skills." So I'm saying to myself, well, this book is not going to be much help. And in fact, it wasn't. And the Texas history book was worse. It was, among other things, it was blatantly racist. But the variety of kids' reading skills ranged from no English whatsoever to pretty good. There were, and everything in between. There were kids who had two kids who just arrived from Mexico, and one of my English, I want to say it was the 7th grade English, but anyway. Then I had kids who had learned English last year, you know, some 2 years ago.
Yeah.
None, except for the few African-American kids that I had that year, had English as a native language. They were all they spoke English as a second language, a term that didn't exist in those days. So I marched down to the principal's or the counselor's office it took me a week or so to discover that the two Martinez kids, who were brothers and sister in my 7th grade class, didn't speak any English whatsoever. And so I marched down and I announced indignantly that a mistake had been made, which brought a look of withering scorn from the counselor. I said, well, there surely has to be some special class for these kids, and I was told no. I said, well, what do you expect me to do with them in an English class when they don't speak English? And she said, well, appoint a translator, as though that would solve the problem.
Yeah.
So I went to a local bookstore and bought Mi Primero Libro de Español and Mi Segundo Libro de Español and a Berlitz book on how to speak English for Spanish speakers. And then I had those two students brought up to my desk, I picked this one kid I decided was pretty bright. Said, Richard, do you speak Spanish? And he looked at me like I was crazy. He said, Mr. Cole, I'm Spanish all over. So I said, well, you tell them, get the Martinez kids up here, tell them that I'm going to teach them English this year and they are going to teach me Spanish. Every Friday we will exchange a list of words.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give them 20 English words they have to know and they'll give me 20 Spanish words. And I began to learn Spanish. It was definitely segregation at its most damaging. The dropout rate in that school, I was told, was 96%.
Jeez.
They didn't keep really dropout figures, but I was told that 4% of our students would go on to graduate from high school, which comports with what I saw happening.
Mm-hmm.
School had was really pretty new, was only 12 years old, but it looked as though it was ancient and, in fact, was in pretty bad shape. They only had two janitors for the whole school. And no air conditioning. This is in Corpus Christi, Texas, where temperatures are in the 90s from April through October. I could say, okay, they don't have a lot of money. They can't afford air conditioning, maybe, but they wouldn't buy shades for the windows either, nor screens. So when you open the windows, I can still remember it. I would go in at 7 in the morning because it was a cinder block building, and all the things I'd taped up on the walls, my students' work that I'd put up there where somebody had done really good work would have steamed off overnight.
Yeah, right.
And the humidity in Corpus Christi is about 99% year-round. And so I would go in early, open up the windows, repaste up that stuff, and I would look out the window and you would see this cloud of mosquitoes slowly rising out of the grass, getting ready for the assault.
And you're pretty much flying solo, or did you have any support?
Oh, no support, no, none.
Obviously, the chancellor was going to help.
It was strictly sink or swim. There were 7 of us out of a faculty of 35 that were brand new that year. One did not make it till Christmas. She threw her keys down on the principal's desk and walked out before the Christmas break. One left at mid-semester. My best friend that I'd made on the last day of school had his car loaded in a trailer attached in the parking lot on the last day of school. So that left 4 of us. After 3 years, I was the only one left, which is not an unusual story for that sort of thing. It was Al Shanker used to say, you get 3 kinds of teachers in schools like that. You get brand new teachers, incompetent teachers that nobody else wants, and a handful of missionaries. And that's was my experience. There was a small core of us that were there fighting the good fight, and a fair group of those that were there to collect a paycheck, and some that were there who was embarrassing to watch them.
Really?
Anyway,
but you managed to stick with it. And
yes,
to be Teacher of the Year?
74.
74?
Yeah. Well,
so
you know what? Kids give you a good deal of credit for effort. I'm always embarrassed if I meet any of my ex-students that I taught in the first 2 or 3 years, because I know I was... Yeah. I know I was appallingly bad. And I felt it. I felt I was the worst teacher in the history of the world. I knew I was the worst teacher in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted desperately to succeed, and it ate at me all the time.
Sandra Feldman actually left.
Yeah, she quit and had regrouped and came back. Same kind of a thing. Exactly the same kind of a story. It was devastating to want to do so well and try so hard. And now, here's where my personal history comes into it. When I rebuilt cars, nobody cared what I wore to work. They cared nothing about my religion or my politics. And in fact, many of the people I worked with in their personal lives were the scum of the earth. I worked with guys who'd been in prison. One guy had shot his father and killed him. But what they cared about was if we give you a car that's been in a wreck and give you a reasonable time to fix it, does it run? And can you tell that it was wrecked before? When you're finished with it, does it look like it did before it was wrecked? And that was it. That's the bottom line. So, you could tell the boss he was an SOB. In fact, I didn't, but one of my coworkers got into a fist fight with his boss after which he said, "Now do I still have to work on that damn car?" And the guy said, "Yes," and okay. And so they went in. It was all about production. Can you produce? If you can, you got the job. If you can't, I'm sorry. You're a great fellow. We love you. You're fired. When I got into teaching, I discovered it was the exact opposite. Nobody cared if I taught those kids a lick. Nobody. What they cared about, first of all, I had to look decent. I had to sign a pledge saying that I believed in a supreme being, which was a lie, but I figured if they were unscrupulous enough to ask a question, then they should expect to be lied to. There were limits to what you could do. It wasn't like in Abilene where you could get fired for being caught dancing, but and it wasn't like they didn't fire women anymore for getting pregnant, even if they were married. But still, behavior counted for a lot. And most importantly, your book records, and if you were unfortunate enough to have a fourth period class, your locker records. Lockers were given out in fourth period, which was traumatic because if you had seventh grade, fourth period, they gave them these combination locks. So you had to open like 30 combination locks for 6 weeks till they figured it out. They'd be coming in, "Mister, this lock's no good, it won't work." So I have to go out and open it, and then another one would come in, "These locks no good, it don't work." Okay. Anyway, things like that. Yeah. And could you keep, was there, I won't say order in the classroom, that was not necessary, but something less than a riot on a daily basis. The principal, bless his heart, was a wonderful guy, sweet guy, but he did not get out and about and check on what was happening in the classroom. Probably didn't want to know. Wasn't much he could do about it anyway. If he fired somebody, he always had to figure he was going to get a drunk, alcoholic, child molester or something to replace it, so what's the point? So... Anyway, that was very demoralizing. But most demoralizing was just watching those kids get ground up and watching otherwise intelligent, capable young people headed for what you knew was going to be a grim future with nothing you could do about it. The books we were supposed to use were inappropriate. The Texas history textbook had this picture of smiling blacks in a cotton field with a caption that said, "Most slave owners treated their slaves well." That was one example I remember.
And these weren't used, new books, too.
Oh, God, no. These books had been used. I used to say that I was lucky teaching in the brown schools because we got the books just after the whites had discarded them. After we got through with them, then they went to the black schools. These books were so filthy from having been handled. You know, that part where you write this book, it belongs to, had been written in, crossed out, pasted over, new. I mean, these books were 20 years old, falling apart. I would get sick in those early years going down to check out the books because they were covered with mold and mildew and filth. Anyway, in both classes, English and history, that I taught throughout my career, I ceased using the textbooks as soon as I could. Now, one of the things when you start teaching is you don't have anything else. Mm-hmm. You haven't built up a stock, a library, which experienced teachers have. But I built up my library. I scrounged through used bookstores, went to the the warehouses where they kept textbooks that had been were out of adoption, and found, you know, there was a chapter here or a unit there I could use. I would have, these would be classroom sets. It wouldn't be enough to give to the students to take home, which was just as well. Expecting those students to do homework was dreaming. That was one of my early lessons. And you're talking about kids who might be living in a three-room house, what are called shotgun houses. Mm-hmm. You know, they had living room, kitchen, bedroom, with 10, 12 people in it. You're not going to get a kid, he has no place to do his homework. The TV's blaring till, in those days, until it went off at 10:30. Now I guess 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
Noise and plus they had duties of their own. If they were old enough to be in junior high school, when they got home, the girls were helping cook and clean. The boys were likely to be pulled out of school to go help on a roofing crew. So you're not. So it was impractical in the first place to expect a lot of homework. So I created my own curriculum. You couldn't do that these days.
No choice but to do this.
Right. Once we got this assistant principal, real jerk, later on in my life when I was union president, I took him on in a very high-profile case. He came down and said, "It's come to my attention you're not using the official state textbook." And I said, "That's correct. The official state textbook is useless." And he said, "Well, that's the law. You have to use it." So I said, "Okay." So I handed them out to the students according to form, told them, "Take these, put them in your locker. Do not take them home. Do not bring them back to class until I tell you to, which will be the last day of school. You have no excuse to lose this because you're not going to touch it again from now until I get it back." And then I told the assistant principal, we had it signed every student a textbook. It was from that experience that the union sprang, not just mine, but other teachers involved. There was a lot of turmoil in Corpus Christi in those days. There was a lawsuit. The school district had been declared in violation of the law insofar as African Americans were concerned, but they refused to integrate the Hispanic schools. And they maintained, they fought two cases to the Supreme Court. First was that they didn't have segregation for the Hispanics, which they lost. A second case was that Hispanics were not an identifiable ethnic group, which they lost. And they finally, in 1975, began integration of the Hispanics with the Anglos through a program of busing. That was the same year we started the union. Myself, Linda Bridges, the president now of the TFT, and a group of others had been in an independent organization called the Classroom Teachers Association. I'm looking for my picture here. There it is. That is not this picture. It was 1974. We were officers in this. that's me, believe it or not. And this guy, who was elected president of the Classroom Teachers Association, was
a dedicated believer in trade unions.
The Classroom Teachers Association had a loose affiliation, very loose, with a state organization, the Texas State Teachers Association, and even looser with the NEA. You didn't have to be a member of the NEA or TSDA to be in the Classroom Teachers Association.
Right.
And but the NEA and was trying in Texas to move in and affiliate the TSTA, the Texas State Teachers Association, as a statewide group, and then impose mandatory, what they call unified membership. To belong to one, you have to belong to all throughout the state. We were, or at least I was, blissfully unaware of any of those things. We were just dealing with things in Corpus Christi and trying to make the organization act like a union. Even though, frankly, I had no predisposition towards unionism. In fact, I was rather hostile to the, based on my upbringing in West Texas, I never heard two good words said about them. But it also is true that I just assumed that professions improve themselves by forming unions, and it was sort of a necessary evil.
Okay, so you saw unionism as, even for teachers, as a necessary.
Yeah. I never understood all the distinctions people would try to make about the Bar Association, the AMA. I still don't. The word games that got played to me, professional people formed organizations and worked together to try to improve the profession and the industry into which they in which they work. So I wasn't, the AFL-CIO was a total unknown to me. I wasn't all that positively disposed towards it either. But others around me were.
Right.
And in any case, what I did believe was an active, aggressive action to try to fix some of these things we were dealing with. Now, the union began in the West Side schools mostly.
The really hardcore schools that needed most help.
Right.
Right.
These were teachers who were idealists by and large. They were people who believed in education and did not and believed in the equality of peoples and didn't understand how a group calling itself the school board could just write off children right and left. Mm-hmm. Now, at the same time, this being early 70s, our school board in Corpus Christi had been taken over by a group of George Wallace Democrats. They called themselves the Concerned Neighbors. And their one issue was school busing. Now, the real issue was integration, but school busing was the hot-button word. 6 out of the 7 school board members were active in that organization, and the 7th, though not active in it, was sympathetic. Mm. And we didn't know at the time we started the union just how bad the problem was. None of us had been, but I hadn't been active in politics in Corpus Christi except for the sorts of things I thought were my duty, like being precinct chair and attending the conventions and things like that. But anyway, we one of our number, the guy pointed out there, had been to an NEA convention. He was one of those that had joined the NEA, where he saw Al Shanker in action. met with AFT activists and was very impressed. So he also met with an organizer for an organization called the National Coalition for Teacher Unity, which I later learned was a front group AFT was paying to try to bring about mergers between NEA and AFT around the nation. Anyway, he came back and said, you know, we should affiliate, we should form this, we should make our organization into a union, and we should affiliate it with both the NEA and the AFT. Now, this was an independent group, bear in mind.
Yeah.
So, in...
You're trying to tackle everything at once there.
Yeah, 74, 75, we had no idea what we were getting into. 74, 75 school year, we had carried the elections in our independent organization. He was the president.
Do you remember his name?
George Kirk. And we took to our representative assembly a motion that we affiliate dually with the AFT and the NEA. And we passed it. Well, after that, the anti-union folks and the pro-NEA folks got all in a dither. And then followed a spring of 75, a flurry of events. They insisted that we'd done that vote without proper notice, etc. So we called a second meeting, passed it again, overwhelmingly. Then we showed up at our monthly representative assembly, and there were all these TSTA and NEA staff people there. We were caught totally by surprise, and the next thing we know, a motion had hit the floor calling for our impeachment, which failed by one vote. It was a meeting I remember vividly, because as people, as they will, were getting up and leaving the meeting, the NEA staff people were picking up voting cards and voting. Then, that motion having failed, well, I always joked about this one guy who had to go to the bathroom, and while he was out, they moved, since they couldn't impeach us, to request us to resign, and that motion passed by one vote. So,
so we need to go to the bathroom.
Yeah. We took him up on it, just to be blunt. And I said, all right, the NEA does not want us. We'll start an AFT level.
Just like that.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
It was not our intention starting in that process to do that. And in fact, we had had a discussion and we rejected it, you know, in terms of starting an AFT local. But it was clear that we were not going to be able to operate inside that independent organization with NEA and TSDA staff people down there organizing against us. Now, at that time, that independent, out of 2,100 teachers in Corpus Christi, had 1,400 members. And since we had been acting like a union, we had irritated the administration. We'd filed grievances, we'd contested terminations, we'd embarrassed them. There's this one precious case. It was a school in Corpus Christi, Shannon Junior High, that everybody knew was out of control. The principal was, his wife had died, he was heartbroken, and he was just non-functional. Coincidental to this, there was this young coach who had been hired as a tennis coach. He had taken his tennis team in Victoria to the national, to the state championships, and they'd hired him. He had moved to Corpus Christi. And then the usual Byzantine political games in the coaching ranks had occurred. And he found when he got to Corpus Christi, having signed a contract, sold his house, that he was not going to be assigned to be a head tennis coach, but instead was going to teach junior high football at Shannon, which did not make him happy, but he went about it the best way he knew how and actually had a winning record for the first time in any number of years. Huh. But at Shannon, the discipline situation was unbelievably bad. And among other things, the gall-less coach was the principal solution to discipline problems was to have kids sent to the tennis court to stand around. This is a tennis court where our coach could have been conducting lessons, but was being used. And meanwhile, the kids out there are being sent to the tennis court. They're smoking. They're passing dope. They're having a good time.
Yeah.
And one day, two trouble kids that he'd had trouble with consistently got in a fight in his gym, and he went over and broke it up, and one of them slugged him in the process. So he yanked him up by the collar, dragged him down to the principal's office, kicked the principal's door in, threw the two students in, and said, "If you'd get off your ass and do your job around here, we wouldn't have these kinds of problems." Not the most delicate way of dealing with the situation, even though he probably was accurate in his assessment. So the principal moved to fire him, of course. And we insisted on a public hearing, which you had then and have now the right to in Texas. I always said, you know, teachers don't have many rights in Texas, but they have the right to be raped in public if they choose to do so. So we had a lot of fun. We hired a photographer, for example, so because we knew what they would do. And the principal said, "That's not," when we talked about the tennis court, "That's not true. We don't have this." So then we have our witness, a photographer. "Are you a photographer?" "Yes." "Did you take this picture?" "Yes." "What is it?" "This is the tennis courts at Shannon Junior High." "What are those?" "Students."
"Yeah."
"What's that one doing?" "He's smoking something. I think it's pot." Whereupon the school board closed down the hearing, threw everybody out, including our attorney, and then voted in secret to fire the person.
Yeah.
Things like that have been going on. Now, this independent association had an agreement with the school board, which was designed to keep the union out, both the NEA and the AFT, frankly. Mm-hmm. More the NEA than the AFT. And it gave them exclusive rights and exclusive right. Collective bargaining for teachers is illegal in Texas, and it was then. But it gave them the right to consult exclusively with the school district. And this right had been conferred upon them with teachers having no voice in the matter and just been designated as that. But because of the way we'd been acting, the school board decided it was going to punish the Classroom Teachers Association by taking that exclusive agreement away. All of this was occurring during this spring of 75. And they subsequently did do that. First time I ever picketed any place was we organized a picket to protest them taking that agreement away. And I did not speak to the school board that night, but others did, including a state representative who said, "You're going to regret the day you did this because you're going to let the union in."
It seems like they poisoned the well.
Oh, yes.
Hugely, again.
Anyway, we started the union. Actually, we started organizing in the summer of 75. We formed an organizing committee.